Welcome to the OIS Podcast, where you get candid conversations with the leaders and drivers of ophthalmic innovation. And now, here's our host, Tom Salemi.
Hey, everyone. Tom Salemi here. This is the OIS Podcast. Thanks for joining us. Our guest today is fresh off his debut performance at the J.P. Morgan Healthcare Conference. It is Cedric Francois, the president and CEO of Apellis. Apellis, of course, went public last fall, raising $170 million. So Cedric, as a reward, got to present at the iconic healthcare conference. So we'll talk to a bit about Cedric about that presentation. We'll talk about the IPO, about what it took to go public, and about its history, the company's history, in trying to reach the public markets. We'll, of course, get into its clinical trials. It's got some news this year, expecting later this year to begin a phase three clinical trial on its lead product. And Francois has got an interesting plan for that, and certainly something worth listening to. And finally, we talk a bit about the pricing of drugs and what companies should be doing to prepare for a commercial launch, even if they're still in clinical trials. Before we get into our conversation with Cedric Francois, I did want to remind you that OIS at ASCRS is happening in Washington, D.C. on April 12th. You have until February 1st to secure our introductory low price of $895. The full price is $1,095. So if you want to save yourself a couple hundred dollars, please do register for OIS at ASCRS by February 1st. Now let's get into this conversation with Cedric Francois of Apellis. Well, Cedric Francois, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Tom. Very happy to be back.
Excellent. We've counted. This is your third time back, so you're the next one will be free. Just make sure you get your card punched before you go. You've got a lot of news. You've been a busy person. Let's first talk about last week. You've presented at many OISs, so I know you know what you're doing with a PowerPoint and a podium. But this was your first time presenting at the J.P. Morgan Healthcare Conference. What was that experience like?
Well, it was special. It was fun. First of all, they had actually co-scheduled us with Jamie Dimon, which was great because there were only I think like a couple of people in the room, most of which were my management team. It was like a, I don't know, like a living room gathering in a way. And but you know, I mean, on the substance side, it's a story that we know well, and it was great to tell it to the broader public.
That's great. Yeah, I guess it's a hazing for the first time companies, huh?
Yeah, that's right. Well, it was very friendly. I have to say, I loved it.
So prior to that, what enabled you to present at J.P. Morgan, other than the great story of Apellis, is the fact that you folks went public in November. And you raised $150 million. Was the final tally $150
million? I think it was closer to $170.
Okay.
When you include the green shoe, yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about that experience, if you don't mind. This was something you had tried to do in 2016 and ended up withdrawing the IPO. What changed between 2016 and 2017? Is it just a matter of market conditions, or do you think you were able to get the company in a better position to appeal to public investors, to IPO investors?
Both. Mm-hmm. You know, we kind of, I don't know if you remember, at the end of 2016, the public markets kind of closed in a kind of a pretty dramatic pullback fashion. At the time, we did not have a crossover syndicate of investors that typically supports IPOs, even in times of drought, as was the case back then. And in addition to that, obviously, in the past 2 years, we had the opportunity to gather significantly more data, most importantly, obviously, in geographic atrophy, which is now, you know, our, without question, our most important program.
So what was the IPO process like? Can you, if you were to describe it to a fellow CEO, you know, what are some of your takeaways from the experience? Any tips for folks who perhaps have an idea of going through this process, they hope perhaps in a year or two?
Well, you know, we got fortunate because it was a seamless process. And, you know, my background is in surgery, and I followed the microsurgery class at the time by Bob Ackland. And the first sentence that he said in that class was, the only shortcut in microsurgery that you will ever take is preparation. To some extent, I know it sounds silly and corny, but to some extent that's true. I mean, in a way, because we had a dry run, it's made life a little bit easier when you had to expect. It's a fun process.
And I'm sure that did help. And there is also, I guess, the concern with IPOs. If you don't go out 1 year, you know, maybe you'll be carrying some sort of stigma the next time you go around. But that clearly wasn't the case with Apellis, and maybe isn't the case at all. Maybe it's my misperception. But does anyone bring up 2016 in that decision, or is it just seen as the way of doing business, and that's the nature of the IPO and the IPO window?
I think the egg in the face factor is vastly overestimated. I think if you try to go out without substance and you bring in, you know, probably less reputable banks and then pull out and make a mess of yourself, that's different from having great underwriters and then making a joint decision because the market conditions are not there, building on what you have and then trying again. I personally did not feel any fallout at all from what we did 2 years ago.
Good. That's good to hear. So final question about this business side of things. How is your life different as a CEO of a public company? I would think that when you're a private company, you're spending a great deal of your time looking internally. Now, I'm sure there's a lot more of your attention looking externally.
You would think, but I mean, we're still very young, right? But I don't experience it that way. I mean, we are a company that's focused on fundamentals and on science and medicine and try to run the right trials for the right patients. That hasn't changed. And as far as outwards is concerned, you know, the qualified investors that you need at the end of the day that you need to convince to invest in you, you know, it's not very different doing that privately as from doing that publicly. So I think where it does make a difference, I think, and, you know, we haven't yet experienced that, is that as a private company, you're typically more aggressive with your projected timelines, because missing a timeline, it does not have the kind of the dramatic fallout that it can have as a public company. You know, just kind of being more cautious, more conservative, because, you know, you have that public exposure, which comes with more responsibility. But other than that, I think it's largely the same.
No, that's great. It always sounds like a more stressful existence, being a public company, but you sound as cool and calm and collected as you always do.
Thank you. That's right. It's a good mask.
Well, it's all that OIS training, I'm sure. You can withstand anything. So let's get into the business of things. You've got a busy year coming up for clinical trials for your Philly trials. First, though, bring us up to date on where you are with the data that's coming out. You had released some data in August regarding geographic atrophy. I think you're expecting some next month as well. Why don't you sort of maybe give us part of the pitch that you gave to the folks in the room, your management team in the room at the J.P. Morgan conference?
Yeah, so the Philly trial, which we designed at the end of 2014 with the benefit of hindsight, you know, was executed and gave us about the best results we could have hoped for, in my opinion. At the time, we looked at geographic atrophy and we saw essentially a minefield and a graveyard of experimental therapies. And as you know, that only became worse in the subsequent years with several other failures. And we said, look, if we're going to do a phase two clinical trial, it needs to have real substance and credibility, no matter what the readout is. And that led to what, as far as I know, is the largest phase two clinical trial in GA ever done. So 246 patients enrolled in what is a trial that in design was quite similar to the Mahalo study that was done by Roche Genentech with lampalizumab, which meant that we had three groups of about 80 patients each, a sham control, and then patients receiving either monthly or every other month intravitreal injections with APL2. The primary endpoint in that trial was, again, modeled after what we knew the FDA would expect in phase 3 at the time, with the prospect of, should we have positive data, we want to change as little as we can between our phase two and our phase three readouts. And the way in which you do that, and as many people that listen to this podcast probably know, is you take autofluorescent images of the back of the eye sequentially over several time points. That allows you to measure how large the atrophic areas are and to, by consequence, to measure whether in your treated group the atrophy grows more slowly compared to the control. We then did a primary endpoint analysis over a one-year period, 12 months, again, as the FDA expects you to do, comparing the three groups to each other, but with a couple of finesses in there that are quite important. First of all, we did an 18-month study, not a 12-month study, even though the primary endpoint was measured at 12 months, as you alluded to earlier, that happened in August of last year. But then decided to stop dosing for 6 months and do another measurement at 18 months, after 6 months of non-dosing. And that readout will happen next month. And why is that readout interesting? Because at the time, as we thought about this trial, and we thought about the mechanism by which APL2 works, we kind of thought there would be three periods of responsiveness. The first 6 months in which we did not expect to see too much, the second 6 month period in which we were hoping to see pharmacology, and then that third 6 month period in which we are curious to know whether there will be certain carryover effects from the second 6 month period where we made the observation. Mm-hmm. Now, in the primary endpoint analysis, we measure at the one-year time point, and what we found was that we met our primary endpoint both for the monthly and every other month injected patients, and that we saw an overall reduction of more or less 30% in the monthly treated group and more or less 20% in the every other month treated group. Now, the way in which we analyze the data is using what's called a mixed effect model, which allows you to make up for missing data in a way that's kind of, you know, highly conservative, and also doing something that's called the square root transformation. What that means is that you take the square root of all your values so that a patient who starts off with a large lesion and who by default will grow with much more lesion size can be compared to a patient with a small lesion that might grow at the same rate, but in absolute terms, doesn't expand as much. So that is, it's a good way for us to compare apples to apples, and met that primary endpoint. We're very happy with that. In addition to that, we did several secondary analyses, and all of the sensitivity analyses that we ran in this study gave us the same outcome, but one that I think is particularly interesting, or two. First of all, as we compared the first 6 months to the second 6 months, we saw in the first 6 months a reduction in the atrophic growth in the monthly treated patients by only 10%. In the second six-month period, that had grown to approximately 50%. And as I mentioned, now we will know what happens in that third six-month period where patients are no longer dosed. So you see an increased effect over time that is, you know, quite remarkable with high statistical significance. In addition to that, in this study, we analyzed, obviously, three sets of eyes. But in every patient, only one eye was used, the study eye, and only one eye was treated. Now, we had a lot of patients in our study that had bilateral geographic atrophy in both eyes. So we could do a study within this study where we could compare the patients that, you know, with their study eye to what the fellow eye did in terms of GA growth as well. And it's worth mentioning here that fellow eye was never part of the initial analysis. So it's really kind of a brand new analysis. And there we saw with the monthly treated patients that, again, we had a statistically significant difference between the treated eye and the fellow eye. And more importantly, or equally important, the fact that split between the first 6 months and the acceleration of the effect in the second 6 months, again, was there when comparing these study eyes to a brand new set of fellow eyes. So that's kind of, those are, I'd say, the most important hallmarks of the FILLY study that make us very happy with the readout that we had. With the next month, I'd say the final checkbox to find out, do these lesions start growing again, and at what rate, are there carryover effects? But in the meantime, we are preparing for phase three, and the FDA has allowed us to continue exactly with the line out of phase two. It is worth, I just want to make one last point there, because that's, and it's a bit long, I'm sorry, but there's a lot of things there in the Philly trial. That's the final point I want to make. We did have one, very interesting observation in this phase two clinical trial, which was that we had a disproportionate number of wet AMD conversions in our treated patients compared to the sham control. And our very first reaction to that was obviously one of concern. I mean, is this something that is an adverse event that is hurting the patients? Now, the patients were well followed. These were not significant exudations, very small lesions, immediately picked up, immediately treated with anti-VEGF, and the patients, the visual acuity was preserved, and it was not considered a safety event. In phase three, we can repeat the study as we did in phase two with more patients, and, we will see what exactly that means. But beyond that, the interesting aspect that we found there, and for the retinal specialists that listen to this, this to us is really a fascinating observation. When patients with geographic atrophy convert to wet AMD, the growth of the lesions of GA are reduced in a dramatic fashion all the way to the point of stopping growth completely. That is counterintuitive to many retinal specialists who kind of view those two going in lockstep with each other. And we have a lot to learn now about what wet AMD conversions really mean, but we are interested in knowing whether wet AMD is truly kind of a well-intentioned process of neovascularization as part of a healing response that went wrong with an exudative event, which you then need to treat with an anti-VEGF. So, sorry for that long explanation, but that's the full summary of what we saw in Philly.
Oh, that's fascinating. Did the patients who were being treated in one eye only, did they report a difference? Do they take vision tests as well? Do they notice a difference between one eye and the other?
So the visual acuity is kind of an interesting feature of geographic atrophy. So you might recall that a couple of years ago, the FDA went through 2 or 3 years of deliberation with the retinal community to determine that the lesion size in GA would be acceptable as the primary registration endpoint. And that is because, as you know well, Tom, visual acuity is a little bit of a misnomer for foveal acuity, where what you need to be able to read the chart that gives you your visual acuity score is your central vision, not your peripheral vision. And in geographic atrophy, we have something that is called foveal sparing, which means that the macula is affected, but the fovea is spared. And patients with geographic atrophy, typically for years, will lose their entire peripheral vision and be functionally blind, but still be relatively well able to read a visual acuity chart. So VA, unlike in wet AMD, in GA is a very poor measure of true visual function. Now, the average loss of visual acuity over the course of 1 year in our sham control is approximately one line, 5 letters. So you could run a trial on VA, but you would need a disproportionate number of patients. And more importantly, this is not an average loss of 5 letters. It is a loss that is driven by those patients during that year where the fovea becomes involved. So those patients that, quote-unquote, go over the cliff because the fovea becomes involved and all of a sudden lose 5, 6 lines of vision, those are the ones that on average contribute to that loss. So it's a complicated measure in geographic atrophy, but ultimately, as you know very well, preserving vision in this disease is a really important thing to do.
Hi, everyone. Tom here. I want to take a quick break from this conversation with Cedric Francois to remind you that the Triple Play program is up and running and available until February 1st. Triple Play allows you to save 30% on the registration fee for our 2018 OIS series. So if you register before February 1st for Triple Play, you will save 30% on the registration costs for OIS at ASCRS, which again is happening on April 12th. OIS at ASRS, which is happening on July 20th in Vancouver. And finally, of course, the big one, OIS at AAO. That's taking place on October 25th in Chicago. So if you'd like to save your 30% on those costs. If you know you're going to all three, please do register before February 1st. Now let's get back into this conversation with Cedric Francois. So how will phase three, forgive me if you gave me the numbers, but how will phase three compare in size to phase two?
So phase two was 246 patients. Phase three will be two trials of 600 patients each, more or less.
Wow. And how many clinics will that involve? And are you in the U.S. only, or will you be able to use sites from outside the U.S.?
These are going to be global trials, and we will have to determine how many sites we end up engaging in this process. But I think that if you take the Genentech phase 3 clinical program, which was closer to 2,000 patients and had 300 sites, you're probably looking at a good comparable as to what the ratio of sites versus patients is.
And that trial is scheduled to start in the second half of this year?
That's correct.
So what does Apellis look like now? What are you folks focusing on to get ready for this undertaking? Have you made any additions, bringing in new people, hiring the right firms to help you?
Yeah, all of the above. So most of our hiring is obviously in the clinical division, which is based in Waltham, Massachusetts. But as you go into phase three, you have to start preparing for commercialization, have a very clean CMC process. A well-streamlined regulatory clinical division that syncs with that CMC process, all the CROs properly aligned, all of the regulatory work. I mean, it's a whole undertaking, as you know.
Sure. And at the same time, you're planning a phase two as well for the AMD?
Well, so that goes in line with kind of what we briefly discussed earlier, which is the fact that we want to understand better what these wet AMD conversions mean. And that should be interpreted in two ways. On one hand, what we believe is happening in the retina is that when you treat with APL2, a patient with geographic atrophy, you can slow down or maybe even halt the process of geographic atrophy because you correct the behavior of the glial cells in the retina. That is what we believe APL2 is doing. And when you do that, these glial cells go through a repair function, which is associated with neovascularization, and which can inadvertently lead to exudation. Now, something that is well known from patients who develop wet AMD naturally, so right now in the wide world, is that when you start treating patients with anti-VEGF agents, in about 20% of cases, you need a couple of injections with anti-VEGF, and you don't need further treatment. You know, you can call this modified patients. You know, a cured is probably an overstatement, but, you know, these patients in the long term have the best visual outcomes. The other 80% of patients become dependent on chronic anti-VEGF treatment. And 98% of those patients between 5 and 10 years of chronic anti-VEGF treatment will develop atrophy in the retina. So that is now something that is emerging 10 years after the introduction of Lucentis, something that we'll have to handle and deal with as well. The question that we have is when patients on APL2 who, you know, hopefully can reduce their GA lesions, you know, at the expense sometime of a wet AMD conversion, what does that wet AMD conversion mean? Will we also have the 20-80% distribution between, you know, subacute or temporary anti-VEGF and chronic, or, you know, could it be closer to, for example, 50-50? Because that changes the risk-benefit equation of you're looking at. So on one hand, finding out whether we can reduce the anti-VEGF requirement, and on the other hand, we want to know if you take patients with wet AMD who are chronically dependent on anti-VEGF, and you now add APL2 to the equation, can you kind of push those glial cells through that final phenotype and bring those 80% within that 20% category, which is why we are running a trial right now in patients with wet AMD, dependent on frequent anti-VEGF injections, on one hand for the purpose of safety, on the other hand to find out if APL2 may reduce that anti-VEGF requirement.
And how large will that trial be?
Oh, it's exploratory. It will be probably somewhere between 10 and 20 patients. we're familiar with that design. We've done it before. And with few patients, you can get quite a few answers.
Terrific. Just curious, this is outside of your, this is not what Apellis is doing, but Spark last month made some news with its pricing of its gene therapy drug, Luxturna. And I'm just wondering if discussions like that, high profile discussions like that over pricing of ophthalmology drugs, how that sort of resonates across the industry. Do you folks examine those conversations, the calculations that come up with prices, and does it, and I know you're still in the regulatory phase, you're not in the pricing phase, but does it change the landscape at all for other ophthalmology drugs down there? Does it serve as any kind of indirect comp, or is it a completely different consideration?
Well, you know, there is a silent revolution happening right now in the pricing landscape, and I think any company at our stage that ignores that and kind of focuses on meeting the FDA regulatory requirements, puts itself at risk. Value-based reimbursement is a trend that started a couple of years ago, but is discovering exponential growth right now, where we expect payers to not see this as the exception, but as the norm by the time we, you know, hopefully make it to the market. So we are very actively engaged in payer discussions already now. We are highly committed to value. I mean, we're not interested in going to payers and saying, oh, we met our primary endpoint, pay us this much. I mean, we are, you know, actively working towards better understanding what these therapies really do for our patients. Because we don't want to just stick it up to people's faces, but proudly go to payers and tell them this is really good for you and for patients and well worth it. I mean, that's a discussion courage and that we welcome and that we look forward to engaging in the next couple of years.
Yeah, I did notice in your presentation at J.P. Morgan at one point you said you were after not only efficacy but value to the patient, which I thought was an interesting in language inserted in there. And it's you're right. There's a lot of work to be done by biopharma companies moving out or hopefully moving out on the commercial market someday. So I'm curious, at J.P. Morgan, did you have meetings? Do you have meetings with payers and investors out there? Were you meeting with the same type of people you had been meeting with in the past, or is that change as your company matures?
No, it was quite similar. I mean, you know, it's J.P. Morgan is, as you know, I mean, speed dating with 20 meetings per day, and it's questionable. It's kind of questionable how productive it ultimately is, but as a landscaping exercise, I guess it's useful.
Right, very true. Did you rent out a table at Starbucks for your meetings?
Well, we actually have our CMC division in San Francisco with an office a block away from Union Square.
Oh, my gosh.
We're very spoiled. Yes. We had the coolest meeting room of the entire conference, I guarantee you.
I know who to talk to next time I get stuck out there. So, terrific. Well, I'm glad you had a great meeting, and thank you for taking some time to bring us up to date, and we look forward to seeing you at a future OIS.
Thank you so much, Tom. Great talking to you.
All right, everyone, we'll wrap it up there. Cedric, Francois, thank you so much for joining us on the OIS podcast. I'm glad your first J.P. Morgan experience was a positive one, and congratulations again on the IPO, and we look forward to tracking your progress going forward. Thank you, OIS Podcast listeners, for joining us on the OIS Podcast. If you could do us a few favors, give us a ranking on iTunes or whatever platform you're listening to this podcast, that would help us a lot. Make sure you're subscribing so the podcast is sent directly to your listening device. Just press subscribe on whatever program you're listening to. It's pretty easy, 2 or 3 clicks, and you will have these podcasts sent directly to you. Don't forget to tell your friends if they also love ophthalmology innovation as much as you do. Finally, reach out directly to me, please. My email is tom@healthag.com. That is the word health, followed by letters EGY.com. Healthag is the fantastic company that produces the OIS podcast and the OIS events. Finally, you can also tweet at me. I am @MedTechTom. All right, folks, that's a wrap. Tune in next week for another tale of innovation on the OIS podcast.